Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's so hard to get people to think about food as something political. You know, they just can't do it. And they also can't think of political as anything other than you go to the government and you try to get a law passed.
Christine Barber challenges her students' preconceived notions about food in the courses she teaches at Indiana University. She'll be here with us talking about why making a food choice is an example of political activism. Harvest Public Media takes us to Kansas to see how a three-year-long drought is affecting growers. It's been wet enough in southern Indiana to grow eggplant this year, and we speak with Kim Bryant, who's selling several varieties at the farmer's market. And finally, in the kitchen, we put that eggplant to good use in two very delicious recipes. It's the news at the top of every show. Luann Johnson is here.
Hey, Annie. Last week, First Lady Michelle Obama launched a new campaign called Drink Up as part of her Let's Move initiative. At a gathering in aptly named Watertown, Wisconsin, Obama announced she's hoping to get Americans to drink more water. The Drink Up campaign comes with its own catchy slogan, website, and Twitter hashtag. What it doesn't come with, however, are specifics regarding just how much more water we should drink and why. Obama's advisors have quoted research from the Centers for Disease Control that detail the dangers of low hydration and show that more than 40% of Americans drink 3 cups or less of water per day. However, the CDC hasn't defined exactly what the recommended daily amount is, as it varies person to person, depending on factors such as age and exercise. Is the underlying message here that Americans should cut back on soda consumption? The campaign stops short of saying that. Professor of Nutrition at New York University, Marion Nessel, says she understands Let's Move can't simply come right out and say, don't drink soda, when major supporters include the American Beverage Association. Food waste has been a hot topic on Twitter this week, perhaps because of a recent study from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. It examined the environmental impacts of food waste, and the statistics are staggering. Food waste is responsible for the release of some 3.3 billion tons of greenhouse gases every year. Uneaten food also accounts for a volume of water equivalent to the yearly flow of Russia's Volga River. And perhaps most jaw-dropping, $750 billion worth of food goes to waste annually. Anthony Faggio, CEO of the Natural Gourmet Institute and chair of Slow Food NYC, argues that a culture shift is needed in how people view food. Rather than tossing edible parts of plants, like broccoli stalks, use the entire vegetable. And this episode was produced before we heard the outcome of the vote in the House on a bill that would cut food stamps. Here's the crux of the bill. $39 billion in cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program over the next decade. The proposal differs sharply from a Senate plan passed this summer that would cut roughly $4.5 billion in SNAP money, mostly by reducing administrative expenses. According to a recent government report, SNAP provides an average of $133 in monthly aid to more than 47 million Americans. Want to find out the latest about the vote and other food news? Check out our website. We get news posted all day, every day at eartheats.org.
Twitter and Facebook are the places we first post newsworthy articles. That's all day, every day as well. Find out about the latest in food as soon as we do by searching for Earth Eats. Luann Johnson, thanks for the work today.
You got it.
The drought, now in its third year in parts of the High Plains, is taxing a resource that's been under pressure for decades, the High Plains Aquifer System. The aquifer is enormous, but it's running low in places, forcing a move to dry land farming. But farmers aren't the only ones affected, as Harvest Public Media's Frank Morris reports.
The drought out in western Kansas has been burning up crops, lawns, and trees for 3 years now. But there are places where you wouldn't even know it's dry.
We're at the deep end of the Garden City Big Pool in Garden City, Kansas.
Chelsea Coaxel shows off the 2.5 million gallon swimming pool dug by hand in the 1920s.
Back in its heyday, I think this was considered the largest swimming pool in the world.
It's about the size of a football field, filled from the High Plains aquifer.
It's kind of the the gem of Garden City, I would say.
But it's not really a lot of water.
You mean that swimming pool?
Yeah.
Sure, it's a drop in a bucket. It's nothing.
Rex Buchanan, who directs the Kansas Geological Survey, says Western Kansas towns and industries use only a tiny percent of the water that comes out of the aquifer. Because out in Western Kansas, the signature sound of agriculture isn't a tractor's motor. It's one powering an irrigation pump. There are about 39,000 irrigation wells in Kansas. Many, like this one, chugging away in Haskell County, run day and night for months at a time. By season's end, they will have pumped enough to fill a pool the size of the one in Garden City, more than 700 miles deep. A lot of water. And, according to Rex Buchanan, a real game changer for an arid climate like the one in western Kansas.
You've got packing plants because you've got cattle, because you've got corn, because you've got water. At the end of the chain, you follow the link far enough, it's always water.
But water's getting harder to come by. Across much of the High Plains aquifer, water levels have been falling since irrigation took hold. The 3-year drought has farmers pumping to and sometimes past the legal limit. In southwest Kansas, water levels are plummeting fast, and some wells are running dry. Neighbors are suing neighbors over water rights, and the pain is not confined to the farm.
Just for instance, we have one well with a 4.4-foot drop in static water level, another well with a 10.3-foot drop.
Fred Jones is city manager in Lakin, Kansas, population 2,200.
Another well with a 12-foot drop in static water level, another well with...
And those are one-year drops. Another Lakin well has gone completely dry. The rest have issues.
If you look out past that center pivot irrigation there, you'll see a little white cube, and that's well number 7. That's our most problematic well for uranium.
The rising concentrations of toxins in Lakin's water forced an unpopular construction project on the outskirts of town.
Hello?
Hey,
we're heading right down to the plant.
Jack, I've been locked for you.
That's Mike Heinitz on the phone. He's in charge of Lakin's new water treatment facility.
We're at the City of Lakin nanofiltration water treatment plant.
Heinitz shows off banks of long white filters.
Where we separate off the uranium nitrates.
Connected to a deep injection well to pump toxins coming up from the aquifer here back into the earth. Total cost, $6 million. 1,000 water customers will pay off that debt. Their water bills have more than doubled. Family wells are also going dry.
Everybody's needs a new well.
Reuben Bartell is a second-generation well driller standing in his shop in Meade, Kansas. He's 56 and has forearms that, except for the lack of tattoos, could pass for Popeyes.
I've been really busy. Probably the last 3 years have been the busiest we've ever been. Talking about the depletion in the Ogallala and probably more severe now than it has been.
This all started about 70 years ago.
This is it. This is old rig. Flathead, 8-cylinder inline flathead Chryslers. Two of them. He bought them Army surplus, I understand, in 47.
Anthony Stevenson here is talking about his granddad's old drilling rig. It sits on the side of a field near Ulysses, Kansas, surrounded by dry tumbleweeds and big, rusty steel implements.
This started the irrigation around here. You could water your crops and make a crop instead of having it burn up. So, yeah, when he started drilling wells, the water was easy to get. Now it's a lot tougher.
It's not that the aquifer is totally drying up. But in places, it's no longer yielding enough water to run an irrigation system. Stevenson has switched many of his acres to dry land, unirrigated farming. That's meant a meager harvest of wheat on some fields, and even worse-looking corn on the land where he's trying to grow that crop without irrigation.
Or some of it's already flashing. That brown corn over there, doesn't matter if it rains 10 inches tomorrow. It's done.
Stevenson says that unless his grandkids can figure out how to make crops grow with just a fraction of the water he uses, dryland farming is the future of western Kansas. He just hopes that modern farming techniques can stave off a return to the Dust Bowl when western Kansas has to wean itself off irrigation from the High Plains aquifer. Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media at harvestpublicmedia.org. located on the campus of Indiana University, we here at Earth Eats are inspired by all the different classes and lectures and opportunities available to the students. Quite frankly, we're a little jealous. So today, we're starting a three-part series I'm calling Food School. It's all the perks of having your mind expanded by world-class teachers with none of the homework. We'll speak with three IU professors about their food-related research and see what connections we can draw to our own lives. Today, it's senior lecturer in political science Christine Barber. She teaches the class The Politics of What's for Dinner, mostly to first and second year students, most of whom never thought critically about how their food decisions affect the world. I caught up with her following her talk entitled If You Are What You Eat, Then Who Are You? That was at Big Red Eats Green earlier this month.
It's so hard to get people to think about food as something political. You know, they just can't do it. And they also can't think of political as anything other than you go to the government and you try to get a law passed. You know, the idea that we could have politics in your family. You know, if they, well, who does the cooking in your house? Well, it's mostly my mom. That's interesting. Why is it mostly your mom? Oh, she likes it. Oh, really? She really likes to cook? And if your dad does the cleaning up and you help do the shopping, I might buy that. But if she's cleaning, shopping, and cooking, maybe she doesn't like it as much as you think she does. The idea that our rural roots, our ethnic roots, say something about who we are. So the fact that you have pierogi every holiday and that you sit in the kitchen and you make those pierogi with your grandmother and she tells you what the old country is like, that's about your identity and that's about power. You know, the U.S. government used to try to get immigrant women not to cook the foods of their homelands because they thought because they wanted people to be homogenous. But what they told them was spaghetti is bad for your health. You know, thank God they didn't listen.
Well, one of the things you said today, it's spoken like a true political science professor, every food choice you make is a vote. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Well, I'd like to say that idea originates with me, but I've heard other people make the same argument. How many food choices do you think you make in a day? You know, you get up in the morning, you have to have breakfast. Do you have breakfast? Do you not have breakfast? If you have breakfast, do you eat it in the car? Do you sit down at the table and eat it? Do you have morning TV on while you watch it or eat it? Or do you just sit down and focus and eat mindfully your egg? And that egg, did that egg come from marsh? Did it come from a farmer? If it came from marsh, did it come from a free-range chicken or a regular pent-up chicken? And if it came from a free-range chicken, do you realize that that chicken probably didn't live any differently than the pent-up chicken? Because all free-range means legally is that there's a door that the chicken could go out of its pen if it knew to try. Already, you've got a whole bunch of choices right there, and we have not even gotten you out the door. To try to eat in a truly sustainable way all the time would be an enormous amount of energy and time and resources. I don't know anybody who can do it unless you happen to live on a farm and be completely, you know, everything, you bring in everything and everything, you know. It's not a perfect world, but you try to get most of your votes in the basket of the way you want to live. Because really what you're doing every time you spend a dollar is you're casting a vote for the world you want to live in.
You quoted Mark Bittman as saying if all of us eat three fewer hamburgers a week, then it would be the equivalent of taking the SUVs off the road.
It's said that. I have not independently verified that.
That's Mark Bittman's quote, yeah.
Right. Probably because it's such a great quote. If I verified it and it turned out not to be true, I'd have to stop using it. As long as I credit him, I'm good. I think it's probably true. He's a very careful journalist. But what I want my students to do is to be thoughtful about how they eat. If they decide they want to eat at McDonald's, then I just want them to know what that means. You know, there's two ways you can eat McDonald's. One, you can eat McDonald's with your head in the sand, which makes it hard to chew. But you can do it with, you know, being oblivious to the consequences, or you can say, I don't give a damn. I want to eat this burger. My philosophy about teaching in general is you don't have to come out of here thinking like me. You just have to come out of here thinking. And that itself would be a huge victory.
One of the first things you talked about in this speech today were the hidden costs behind, let's say, that McDonald's hamburger. Probably, I would imagine, for a student who's taking this course, who was not a mindful eater prior to that, would look at this list and think, oh my God, I had no idea. Can you just run down the list of some of the hidden costs of that McDonald's burger?
Well, this list is not complete. If you recall, the list concluded, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But some of the costs of a burger are the medical costs that come from trying to treat antibiotic-resistant bacteria because we feed every single commercial agribusiness cow bacteria in its feed because we're giving it grain, which is not designed to digest, and that makes it sick. So prophylactically, we just give it antibiotics. We have pesticide-resistant pests, which are getting to be harder and harder to control. We have environmental damage that is really untold because we haven't got a good way to calculate it. But not only do we have the fact that we're overusing the land resources, but these confined feeding operations where we grow animals, the runoff from that are killing off the ocean and killing off fish, which is another essential way that we feed ourselves. So there's environmental costs, there's health costs, and then there's all the other costs that are much harder to calculate. Like, you know, if you're getting a fast food burger on the fly, you're not sitting down and having a meal with your family and talking about your day.
Think about all the classes that you've taught, the different students who've come through your door. What is the one issue that the majority of students are just flabbergasted to find out about? GMOs, the hidden cost of food, the environmental impact, what?
I think the thing that shakes them up the most, which is sort of, I mean, I show Food Inc. and everyone's a vegetarian for about 50 minutes to a week. There's, you know, just, oh God, there's the gross factor when they see it. So I think they're surprised at that. But the biggest problem I've had teaching the food politics class is getting students to not think that they are autonomous. They say, oh, I eat McDonald's because I like it the best. I like it better than Burger King. I drink Coke because I think Coke tastes much better than Pepsi. Well, when you went to school, were there Cokes or Pepsis? Oh, well, there were Cokes because my school had a contract. Well, do you think that had any impact on your liking of Coke because you're used to it? Oh, no, I choose Coke. I mean, they don't see that their food choices are the result of anything other than individual choice. So there's lots of things that, from the lighting in the restaurant to the label on the wine bottle to the music that's playing to the colors on the walls, there's lots of things that affect their food choices.
Last question for me. I want to ask you the question that is in the name of your talk. If you are what you eat, then who are you was the name of the talk. So who, Christine Barber, are you?
I am mostly an eggplant. I am a thoughtful person who tries to get it right most of the time. I'm a person who once in a while craves a steak. I just want the choices.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Christine Barber, part eggplant, part political scientist, part senior lecturer at Indiana University. She shared a killer sweet potato recipe with us. Find that at eartheats.org. Eggplant, you say?
Putting two eggplants in this.
Skins and all.
Skins and all, and it's going to give it the little black specks. And then the seeds inside are also a little bit like caviar, if you look at that.
Chef Daniel Orr makes a baba ganoush, but he's calling it a very fancy eggplant caviar. Thank you very much. Before that, he gives us some tips for how to tackle this sometimes intimidating fruit.
Maybe it's the scallions. Maybe she's Italian. Can't reveal a name, but eggplant is her game. When my baby cooks her eggplant, she don't read no book. She's got a Gioconda kind of dirty look.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We have just the regular Black Beauty. I pick them small and large because people like, you know, choices.
That's Kim Bryant of Bryant Farms in Ellettsville, Indiana. She's brought a few varieties of eggplants to the market today.
I grow the Ping Tang Asian eggplant.
That's this?
That's the longish purple. I, again, pick them, you know, larger, smaller. And then this is the fairy tale eggplant. It's a miniature version of, you know, like the Ping Tang, really. A lot of people like it, you know, for sautés, stir fries, shish kebabs. It's real popular for that.
Bryant says growing eggplants is tricky. They require a lot of babysitting.
It's about 3 months before you really get them going good. And if you've succeeded in keeping them happy that whole time, they produce like crazy.
How long will these be in season?
They probably have another month. Usually mid-September, they're starting to give it up. What affects them most is the daylight. When it starts getting shorter, then it kind of makes them grow lopsided or something.
We've heard from our listeners that eggplant is tough to cook. I wonder why that is.
A lot of the problem people have is that there's a touch of bitterness in some eggplant, and that's been breeded out of a lot of these plants now that we get here in America. But if you get a nice firm eggplant and it still has a touch of bitterness in it, you can salt it first. What you do is you slice it and sprinkle it with some kosher salt, let it sit for a while, and you'll see that it kind of pulls a lot of the moisture out. Then you rinse those off, pat them dry, and there's another benefit by doing that is they'll absorb less grease when you cook them. Another thing I like to do if I'm making an eggplant parmesan or some other dish that typically used fried eggplant in, you can grill the eggplant instead. Brush it with a little bit of olive oil and season it with some garlic, salt, and pepper. And then one last trick is roasting the eggplant. You can puree that and make your baba ganoush and different eggplant sauces and dips and things with that. Or you can slice it and roast it on a cookie sheet with just a little bit of olive oil, and that way you won't be deep frying it.
Now let's go to the kitchen for our first eggplant recipe.
Today we're going to start with a eggplant caviar. And it's a spread that you can use in a lot of different dishes. What I've done is I've roasted some eggplants. So we're going to, you want them to be very, very soft. Just going to cut them up. Okay, and then in my food processor, I'm going to add some seasonings. I've got some whole fennel seeds, which have that kind of anise flavor. I'm going to add some crushed red pepper flakes, some garlic cloves, a little bit of curry powder, and some salt. And I'm going to grind all these spices together. Also, by grinding the fennel seeds, I'm releasing the essential oils from them, and they're going to be much more aromatic. You could even take it to another level and toast the fennel seeds beforehand in a dry pan. It really brings out a whole different level. It's done a lot in Indian cuisines, the roasting of the spices. All right, now I've got those in there. I'm going to add my eggplant, putting two eggplants in this.
Skins and all.
Skins and all, and it's going to give it the little black specks. And then the seeds inside are also a little bit like caviar. If you look at that, I'll pull out a few of these anchovies.
Love it. I didn't know we were going to get anchovies today. I'm excited.
Now, these are the salted anchovies, which come packed in oil. And we're just going to dice them up. And that's just going to give it a little more depth and flavor. And that will be the little je ne sais quoi that people ask, what's that in there? Okay, a little bit of extra virgin olive oil. I'm going to finish it up by tasting it, adding a little bit of lemon juice to it. Now, you could take this in all different directions. You could add some mint to it, which would be delicious. You could add some tahini to it, which would make it a baba ganoush. You know, it's classic throughout the Mediterranean region. And that is our caviar d'aubergine, or eggplant caviar.
Now, a recipe for eggplant fries that will keep you coming back for more.
Like I often say, there's a vegetable or something that you're afraid to try to make it into something that you really like. And everybody loves French fries. So I've cut these into little thin strips, about a quarter to a half inch thick. What we're going to do is to degorge them, which means that we're going to salt them, and we're going to let them sit for about a half an hour. And what you're going to see, they're going to kind of weep a little bit, and the moisture is going to come out of them. All right, now we're just going to make the fry batter for them. Okay, so for this we're going to beat together one nice farm fresh egg. We've got a quarter cup of milk. We've got a little bit of our Greek seasoning, which has some oregano and sea salt in it. A little bit of garlic powder. And a little bit of smoked paprika. I don't know if you've ever had smoked paprika before.
Oh, that's, I can smell the smokiness.
Yeah, it's really smoky. It comes from Spain. I'm going to add just a little bit of sorghum. Sorghum, that's going to allow them to brown nicely. Anytime you add a pinch of sugar or sweetener to a batter, that's to help it caramelize and brown. Okay, we're going to add our rice flour, and we're going to add a little bit of cornmeal. And you just want it fairly loose so it coats the eggplant well. Okay, we're going to take this back and fry our eggplant fries. And I like to leave that skin on these because you can see it really adds kind of a dramatic color difference between the golden eggplant and that dark skin. It has a nice texture to it as well. It's one of the great things about eggplant is it's kind of like tofu or chicken breast. It's a blank canvas, and you get to create whatever you'd like out of it. There are other dishes I like to do on the grill, and the grill will give it a smokiness. You want to cook eggplant until it's soft. So when you touch it, it should be a little bit mushy. It shouldn't be firm at all. If it's firm, it tends to be undercooked, and that's where your bitterness will come. Now, we have the eggplant coming out now. You can always have a little draining station set up. We have a little pie pan here that we have some paper towel in. Anytime you fry something, you always want to salt it right when it comes out of the fryer, because that way the hot oil will make the salt adhere to the fried item.
These really do like big, rough-cut French fries here.
Right, and then we're going to just put them on a plate with some of my garlic aioli. And that's all there is to eggplant French fries.
We collected a whole bunch of eggplant recipes and posted them on the website, deliciousinspiration@eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Christine Barber, Aobon Binder, Kim Bryant, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. It was a fun one today. Thanks for being here. And we hope to see you next week. I'm Annie Corrigan.